You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
I'm Christy Niebel, filling in for David Gilmore. Today we have Holly Hughes with us. Holly J. Hughes is the author of Hold Fast, Passings, and Sailing by Ravens, co-author of The Pen and the Bell, Mindful Writing in a Busy World, editor of the award-winning anthology Beyond Forgetting, Poetry and Prose about Alzheimer's Disease, and co-editor of Contemplative Approaches to Sustainability in Higher Education. Her fine art chapbook, Passings, received an American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation in 2017. Her poems have been nominated for a Pushcart Prize, were featured in An American Life in Poetry, have appeared in many anthologies, most recently Poetry of Presence, an anthology of mindfulness poems, and have been set to music by Minneapolis composer Eddie Hill. And I could go on about all of your many experiences and awards and credits as a teacher, but I'd rather move on to the poetry, because that's what we're about. And I will say this about my approach. My father once pointed out to me that poetry is not ideally suited for being read aloud, because the words are best appreciated upon being reread in order to give the mind time to digest complex and multi-layered concepts. So what I want to do is take time with each poem, if you don't mind, to give my own digestion, if you will, in order to allow listeners to do the same thing. Anyway, as with lyrics, I'm always interested in what brought the writer to this moment in time to produce these words. I want more story behind the story. You have a great wealth of stories behind your poems, so bear with me while I explore them. Let's have a poem, please.
Thank you so much, Christy. I'm delighted to be here. And it's really fun in selecting these poems to discover our shared Alaska experience. And so I'm going to start with some Alaska poems. And I'm going to go back even farther and read a poem that is from my childhood. I grew up in the Midwest in Minnesota, and it's kind of unlikely that someone in the Midwest would have a strong yearning for the sea, but I did. So I'm going to start with that poem called Horizon. And there's an epigraph from the poet Brenda Hillman from her collection Cascadia. And the line is, "A daughter grows a horizon, somehow a line by which a life could be pursued." And here's the poem. She's not in the black and white Polaroid with its deckled edge. She's the one you can't see because she climbed out the frame. She's made her escape out the bedroom window with its pink ruffle to the steady white pine with sap she won't wash off. Right now, she hangs on with one hand. Her other hand shields her eyes from the sun. She read this in Treasure Island. And she gazes over the muddy river valley, past the straight green rows of corn, their yellow ears sheathed. She dreams she's in the crow's nest of a ship, watching for white sails, waiting for them to fill with wind, sails that will carry her far from here.
Well, you already answered some of my questions about this, which is whether it was a premonition from your childhood or something you always yearned for to escape to the adventures of the sea.
Yeah, you know, a little beach, and what I discovered later, it was more than a premonition, but I actually have some sailing in my blood. I learned after I'd gone fishing that my great-great-grandfather was an English sea captain, so it sort of made sense, and it helped make sense to my parents, who kept waiting for me to come back from my adventure in Alaska, and I ended up buying a fishing boat, so it was 8 years before I came back, and I do attribute it to that great-great-grandfather and that seafaring blood.
There's something in there that to me is a little reminiscent of Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz being whisked above the images of Midwest farm life into another world.
I hadn't thought about that, but it is. Yeah, I even had a Toto, a different name, of course, but I had my own little dog that we would go adventuring with. So the adventures just, you know, changed landscape when I came out to the Northwest.
One of the things I really like about you is that, unlike other authors that I really love, your writing doesn't focus strictly in on the life of an academic, because you've had another life outside of academia that left you with experiences that made you into a different person.
That's right, and I'm really grateful for that life. And I'm not sure I ever, even when I was in academia, I ever wrote much about that. I tended to write more about, Alaska, the outer world, and I guess somewhat the inner world too. But, my work has always been pretty grounded in place, whether it's Alaska or here in the Pacific Northwest. I think that's where I tend to draw my inspiration.
So let's have another poem.
Okay, we're still in Alaska. We're continuing our adventure. My former husband and I, we met in college and we went up to Alaska to make money for graduate school, and we fell in love with Alaska and ended up wanting to stay there and not just, you know, see the country, just travel through as a tourist, but actually stay and work. And we ended up buying a fishing boat, a gillnetter, at the end of that season. And so here we were, two kids from Minnesota who, you know, had grown up on lakes that didn't have tides. We had a lot to learn. But we did, thankfully. We were taken under the wings of some very generous mentors, some of the old-timer fishermen, and we did okay. One of the things I gained from those 4 years, and really pretty immediately, having growing up a long way from the sea, is a huge respect, a healthy respect for the sea. In this poem, it refers to the log, and we did keep not only a log of where we were going, but a log of what we caught. And so that's what the poem is about in part. And it's called What the Sea Takes, Gives Back. One day's catch recorded in the log, 40 sockeye, 15 chums, 7 cohos, a white king. A receipt book, yellow pages, thick as an accordion. Plastic Joy soap bottle, 1 tennis shoe, left its tongue swollen. What we keep, what we toss. The day I dropped the fish pick overboard, watched it sink out of sight, next set, fetched up by the net. The night the storm petrel skittered down on deck, rode with us across the gulf, then flew. What the sea takes, gives back. The fisherman, gone overboard, found the next morning, boat adrift, tangled in his net.
This is really powerful to me. It has images of detritus that come up from a fishing net, giving one the sense of a message of our species ruining the floor of the sea with our garbage, which seems like an environmental warning. Then it moves into the actual catch of the day, which I found interesting just because it included so many of the species of salmon. I don't think a lot of people know that there are 5 different species and that they have different schools, they have different rhythms, they come in different years, they spawn, and I think of them as moving in different areas of the ocean, but obviously that's not true because you got a whole bunch of different species in here. I don't suppose that's interesting to people who didn't live in Alaska. Sorry, folks. The really big and brutal jolt at the end with one sentence is what got me. It put a moral clinch to the poem, to me, with this vivid image of the fisherman who drowned in his own net. And that made me wonder if you're making the point that the sea deserves a bit of revenge now and then to even the score.
Boy, Christy, I hadn't thought of it in the terms of sea seeking revenge. But, you know, the sea, I have a poem in which the sea is personified. I mean, she's a powerful force. And, you know, I guess what I was going for in this poem was really just that the risks you take, I think, when you're fishing, that you just never know. And, you know, all of these were true stories. The fisherman gone overboard, that was a true story, and it haunted me. And so it eventually did make it into a poem. It just sort of came along. But it did, in the context of, you know, what the sea takes, gives back, you know, that we were taking from the sea all these beautiful fish, all these salmon, and thank you for recognizing the different species. That was a good day's catch, you know, and typically we're just fishing one species at a time. That particular place was sort of we were further out to the West Coast, and it was kind of a rich convergence of different currents. And so we did catch, it was in the, I think late August, because the sockeye run was winding down and the chums and cohos typically come in later in the year. And it's always amazing to catch any kings, but especially a white king, which are, you know, not as common. And in those days, you know, they weren't yet known for this delicacy, and we could only sell them to the cannery for 25 cents a pound. So we'd keep them and smoke them and eat them ourselves. So, yeah. But, you know, the listing of what comes up in the net was all true. That is what we would often find. And I hope it's better. I don't know that it is. But, there's the garbage patch out mid-Pacific has me pretty concerned.
Well, let's move to Rocky Pass. Now, Rocky Pass is familiar to me. This has references to different things. Rocky Pass itself is a notoriously treacherous place with lots of shallows that are home to riptides and unpredictably brutal weather. So let's hear it.
Okay, thank you for knowing that about Rocky Pass. Not most of my listeners don't. So this is September letter from Rocky Pass. Marine radio calls for gusts up to 50. Rain thrums on the wheelhouse roof. Wind shrills in the rigging as another fall squall rolls through. On the back deck, five crabs scuttle in a blue bucket. Their scratch is startling until I realize what makes them think how good they'll taste for dinner. Yesterday I found a Steller's jay, breast picked clean, only tail feathers intact. One creature dead, another about to be eaten, the line crossed in a wing beat. 2 days ago we ran aground, had to wait for the rising tide to float us. We could see the channel from where we were, but that didn't much matter. I can't put that jay out of my mind. When Steller saw him, he knew they'd reached Bolshaya Zemla. His servant shot the bird to bring home, and Steller drew the jay in all its blue-black beauty. How young Steller was, how difficult the voyage, bearing sick, crew weak from scurvy. Still, he wrote in his log, the voyage was a success, though that winter, most of the men died. In a few hours, this storm too will pass. We will eat crab for dinner, crack and pick each red claw clean, and forget to think enough about it.
You got me interested in Steller, so I did a little research. I think most people here also don't know that what we think of in the Puget Sound as a blue jay is a Steller jay, Steller's jay. And I didn't know anything about Steller. Now I do. He went on an exploratory voyage with Bering from Russia to bring back information about the wildlife, and they ran aground. Very interesting character. And what's also interesting to me is the last line. It made me wonder, does it ever seem to you that the lessons and memories from your adventures in Alaska came as suddenly as they also became necessarily unforgettable? It almost seems as if you wrote that last line just to underscore the need to remember the lesson of the day.
Thank you, Christy. Yes, I think a lot of times my poems are just me trying to remind myself, you know, either to pay attention or to be grateful or you know, and just, I think traveling in those circumstances, and I was reading about Stellar. There's a beautiful book called Where the Sea Breaks Its Back, which chronicles, you know, Stellar's expedition. And it was he had a tragic life. You know, he was young, and, you know, he had collected all these specimens, and when they were shipwrecked, at some point, they were shipwrecked, and then on the way home, when they had to dump his collections overboard to lighten the load, and then he died of tuberculosis, I think, or died of pneumonia that winter. Anyway, a really tragic life. And so it's not that, I guess I want to keep Stellar alive in my memory, but I just also, just that sense of how precious every life is, you know, the crab, the Stellar Jay.
The petrel,
yes. Yes, and how I need to remind myself to be mindful of that.
Well, shall we move on to another poem?
Sure, yeah. I guess I've moved on in my journey. We fished for 4 years in Southeast Alaska and loved it. Beautiful little 33-foot boat, but we were both starting to feel restless, wanting to explore more of Alaska. And so we sold our boat and got on with running a tender. And tenders are the larger boats, usually 80 to 100 feet, that pick up fish from the fishermen and run them to the canneries or the processing ships, depending on where you are. And I, at this point, fell in love with navigation. I love the instruments. I love kind of the very mindful practice. You really have to know where you are at every moment or you can get into big trouble. And I started to read more about the history of navigation, too. And in my collection, Sailing by Ravens, a lot of those poems are exploring some of the history of navigation. In this one, this was my own experience. I'd gone aboard one of the big freighters, the Japanese trampers that were anchored outside of, we were tendering in Bristol Bay, and there's this whole city of lights offshore that were all the Japanese trampers, and the fish would be caught, gone to the tenders would take them to the processing ship, and the processing ship would take them to the trampers, and the trampers would take them to Japan. They were just headed for Japan. And on one of those trampers, I saw what was to me a new instrument of navigation, a gyroscope. And that would actually measure not straight lines, but curve lines. And it's described as you can sail a great circle route. Going back to Japan, that's what all those ships were doing, is sailing great circle routes. And so I wrote this later, but that, again, that image stayed with me. She dreams of great circle sailing. The shortest distance between two points, a line, but only if this world is flat. As the crow flies, a better measure for where dreams venture. Soft swell of horizon, woman's breast, lines that wander before finding home. Not lines, but curves, like barrel staves around this spinning earth, follow sun's arc across the sea. Consider stars' sidereal praise, stones ripple, mare's tails combing empty skies. Bend of mast, billowed sail, hearts swell, ever out toward that curved horizon wind carries. How will she learn to ride the swell? Let the earth curve her.
It's a very feminine image of curves. It seems to be almost a girl looking ahead to her own curves and her own empowerment. And you definitely got empowered as a skipper.
Well, I did and I didn't. I mean, it's interesting, Christy. You know, you were in Alaska during that time. I fell in love with navigation and I ended up with enough sea time to get my license. And I was really glad I did. And, you know, that the marine world was, you know, pretty male dominated at that time. That's changing, I'm happy to report. And I think some of what comes out in this poem was perhaps the feeling of living in a male world, kind of dominated by these Western ways of knowing. and just having a sense that there was, for me personally, there was more to it that I needed to explore. And so I think that's where some of that feminine imagery comes in, is wanting that empowerment.
It kept coming back to me how a woman handles all the curves that are thrown towards her. How you're going to deal with all those curves in your life and your body and everything ahead.
Oh, that's great. I love that. Oh, yeah.
Oh, and I have to mention that what the audience out here in the show can't see is that the poem is laid on the page in a concave curve.
Yes. Thank you for noticing that. I do like to play with form in my poems, and that was, of course, a deliberate choice. So moving away from the left margin straight across to a poem that shows a curve. Yeah, thank you. You may see that again. I know, and I wish there was some way to let the listeners know that, so I'm glad you mentioned it.
I will mention these things.
Good.
So poems, more poems, please.
Okay, well, the next one, you know, speaking of wanting a different way of knowing than the kind of Western grid, latitude, longitude, I started to feel a little trapped by that, even though I love learning about it, love learning about maritime history. At some point, I knew that there were times when I was going by instinct, and the instinct was also worthy. It had its own kind of credibility. And that as I think I wrote this after my husband and I had split up, I was on my own and knowing that I really did have to listen to an inner voice. And so this was written after Alaska, but it was based upon a story I heard that sort of explained something to me and made it into my collection. It was a story of a woman in the Gulf of Mexico, actually, who was lost in a fog and then was able to find land, save herself by following the monarchs who are heading south. And so so the title of the poem is Steering by Monarchs. And the epigraph is a line from the poem I read this in. It's Alison Hawthorne Deming, a poet I really admire. And she has a whole collection called The Monarchs. And the epigraph is, she forgot the instruments and steered instead by butterflies, knowing nothing human could be that sure. And then I wrote the poem as sort of a persona poem, trying to put myself in the shoes of that person on that boat, that woman. So those are the images that you'll be seeing. Fog thick enough to lick, horizon a blanket, pearl gleam of sun. Sure, the sea trips the mind, conjures creatures, but what's this dusty heartbeat of wing? First one, then another, and another. How to account for this river of wings flowing south through generations? She watches the monarchs drift, cloud of orange and black. Western mind says discount, but knows better than to dismiss. She abandons the instruments, tracks by dusty heartbeat, joins the wavering, certain path.
That's really beautiful. I see it's the second poem wherein you insert someone else's poem. And I find that interesting in that you've shown a sense of generosity toward other poets, as well as an openness toward the idea of being inspired by them, which is, I think, maybe unusual among poets. But I think it's really interesting, this notion of the act of faith of navigating by instruments that would seem to be reliable enough to put your very survival into them. But we all discount the reliability of the navigational instincts of an insect. With our Western minds.
That's right. Yeah. And certainly I'm not, you know, I love GPS. I mean, I learned on the traditional tools and I'm really glad. I mean, now when you go aboard a boat, there's a GPS and a plotter and it's pretty foolproof. When I was fishing in Bristol Bay, you know, we were using Loran and it wasn't foolproof. You know, we'd end up a river and then we didn't have a signal. And then you were really up a river without without an instrument. And so I think what I came out of all those experiences with is the importance of both, you know, that it's not either or, but both and that there were times when I was out at sea and I didn't trust what the radar was telling me. And so I just turned back out and waited till morning where I could see, you know, the land. And I guess that's what I liked about this account of this woman is that, you know, the instinctual movement of monarchs or birds, their migrations, you know, they have their own really finely tuned instruments that they're following. I wanted to honor that. It's, of course, not practical to navigate that way. Most, you know, very rarely does it work. But in that instance, it worked for that woman. I love that story.
I've read Jonathan Raven's passage to Juno. Have you read that?
Yes. Uh-huh.
He talks about how the early explorers misinterpreted the Native Americans who were in their canoes out in the waters doing what they thought was nothing. Yeah. But in fact, they were reading the water.
Right. Yeah.
They had a reason for staying in one spot and not going into dangerous places.
Right. Yeah, and there's some wonderful accounts of the Polynesian sailors who sailed all over the Pacific, and they could read the direction of the swell, you know, through the base of the canoe that they were in. So it was a real bodily knowing, and I love that.
What I remember about Jonathan Raven is that he just liked to look at the shapes and the ripples in the water, which were, I guess, somewhat plaid. They showed different cross lines that indicated on one side where the shore might be and on the other side where the weather might be coming in or something like that.
Well, and I remember another little item I remember from that book that was, you recognize that is some of the way that the waves move, it's kind of elongated shapes. And then when he saw the, I guess, Tlingit and Haida, totem carvings, he recognized some of those shapes.
Ovoids,
exactly. And I really loved him making that connection. Yeah.
You remember the same things I do that he's written.
That's great.
I'd like to interview him.
I appreciate that you acknowledge. I often work inspiration from other poems, and it's a nice way, I think, to have a dialogue, a sense of communication. So I love to start out with an epigraph from another poet and then to kind of respond. My poem becomes sort of a response.
Thank you so much, Holly Hughes. I hope we can do this again.
I would love to, Christy. This has been a delight. Thank you so much. I love having somebody who's so familiar with the land and waters that I'm writing about.
You've been listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH FM 101.9. I'm your host, Christy Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore, who is on hiatus, and we've been listening to the Indianola poet, Holly Hughes. Thank you for joining us, Holly.
It was a-